Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Life Between the Tides by Adam Nicholson, narrated by Leighton Pugh.
Introduction. The Marvelous. The sea is not made of water. Creatures are its genes. Look down as you crouch over the shallows, and you will find a periwinkle or a prawn, a claw-displaying crab, or a cluster of anemones ready to meet you. No need for binoculars or special stalking skills. Go to the rocks, and the living will say hello. In the 1850s, when Victorian Britain fell in love with the seaside, the rock pool became the heart of a kind of nature worship, which saw in its riches and calm a reassuring vision of creation. Life in what Philip Henry Gosse, the great apostle of the pools, called these unruffled wells, was a gathering of goodness and even happiness. It was as if the pools came from a time before the fall, when life was innocent and unthreatened. Gosse, surely half remembering the children's rhyme, imagined Adam and Eve stepping lightly down to bathe in the rainbow-coloured spray. At just the moment Darwin was challenging the God-ordained vision of nature and setting the whole of life adrift on chance-driven change, the rock pools looked to those Victorians like gardens of pre-lapsarian bliss, glimmering enclosures in which nature seemed to have enshrined perfection and permanence. We have inherited some of that Victorian longing for calm. We still go to the seaside for consolation and simplicity. Demands and anxieties seem to drop away there. Things still are as they were when we were 10. The rock pools still beckon, the blennies and gobies still shimmer beneath us. But there are ironies in choosing the shore as a theatre for reassurance. Even if its changes are dependable and rhythmic, it is thick with variability. A tidal coast is filled with that paradoxical quality, reliable unreliability, both closed and open-ended, both familiar and strange. Regularity toys with uncertainty there. Nothing is more predictable than the coming and going of the tide, and yet nothing about it can be relied on. Daily revelation and daily erasure, daily loss and daily reacquisition. This book is about those multiple layers between the tides, the ways in which the simple overlies the less than simple there, the extraordinary mirroring of human and animal life on its shores, in pools that are silent and beautiful, and as full of threat as any rat's alley or Roman circus. The intertidal is rich but troubled. As no coincidence, it is one of the most revelatory habits on earth. Of all the great discoveries made in the science of nature, from a grasp of taxonomy to the sequence of creatures through time revealed in the rocks, the adaptations of organisms to circumstance, the idea of natural selection, finally crystallizing in Darwin's mind as he spent 8 long years examining the inner structures of the barnacle, the working of ecological webs and the governing importance of trophic cascades, all these ways of understanding the pattern of life first emerged from studying what was happening to animals and plants between the tides. It is where you can look beyond your own reflection and find the marvellous an inch beneath your nose. The soul wants to be wet, Heraclitus said in Ephesus 2,500 years ago. That is the impulse this book follows. It began for me in springtime, 30 years ago. I had not long known Sarah, who was soon to be my wife, when she took me to a place she had known since she was a girl. Her family had been coming there for years, far out on the west coast of Scotland, in Argyll, where David Balfour, in Kidnapped, had found the sea running deep into the mountains and winding about their roots, an intercut geography as serrated as a comb. Even on the map, land and sea there is as interlaced as the fingers of two hands. We stayed the night about 10 miles away in a small guest house on the shores of Loch Sunat. A polite atmosphere, cloths on the tables, charming, smiling service at dinner by the man who owned the hotel, a retired biologist who dipped the end of his tie in the parsnip soup as he set it down in front of us. No one in the dining room said a word. The butter came on silver scallops. The oat cakes were in their own airtight tin, and we whispered our secrecies over the venison and the crumble. Next morning, up early through the Atlantic oak woods, radiating their springtime green. Late May is the moment of perfection, when the West Highlands start to acquire that burnish and glow which coats them for a few weeks at the beginning of summer. Cuckoos in the alders, black caps in every other tree, pied wagtails down on the wet rocks, the hollow notes of other, more distant cuckoos sounding as if they were calling through cupped hands. Everywhere, the shadowed hyacinth blue of the bluebells and their scent. Up out of the woods and on to the top of the hills, the whole riven province of Morven, a mountainous fin of Scotland 80,000 acres wide and almost entirely surrounded by sea lochs, was laid out below us. We skirted the shoulders of the mountains and dropped to the pastures of a salmon river, past the freshwater loch at its head, where the water slid out over the sandy beach, braided like silk, looking like whiskey, and then along a heron-haunted shore to the sea. 3 miles to go. At last we rounded a corner, past an 18th-century steading now used to shear and dag the sheep, and as the track turned, the bay appeared below, wide and tall, a world in itself, a half-circle of dark cliffs and wood-thickened slopes, the rim of those cliffs about 700 feet above the sea, waterfalls dropping over them at intervals and through the woods to the rocky shore. A track hairpinned steeply down under the old lime trees. It felt, as all good places feel, hidden from the world, enormous and strangely private. The bay looked out to the south, to the hills in Mull. To the southeast, 7 miles away, the single white finger of the lighthouse on Lismore. Behind it, the hills above Oban. This was the geometry. Away from the wind, a cliff-backed semicircle of a bay, about a mile across and reaching half a mile in from the waters of the Sound, with strongly marked headlands at each side, the one to the west, made of basalt, that to the east, of limestone. The head of the bay is lined with a dark beach, black basalt sand, the ground-down lavas from a volcano in Mull, lighted only with a scatter of broken cockles, an occasional bit of sea glass, the bottom of a bottle, some old limpets and mussels. Across it a small burn emerges from the flag irises of a bog and makes its way in zigzags that change with every tide and storm. Even now, on each arrival, I go down to the beach. On the ebb, mounds of seaweed, most of it serrated wrack, lie about on the muddy, sandy surface. They look like piles of day-old salad. The sea extends away down the Sound in a perfect mirror. The abandoned shells lie on the drying sand. One half of a razor clam is out in the air, its gloss gone. There are some worm casts and a barnacle-encrusted rock, a bruised and battered lump of the ancient rocks brought here by the glaciers from further east. I wade out into the shallows where, a foot deep and an hour before low water, the last of the tide is running between my calves. little counter-worlds of current flicker in the surface just downstream of me. This is the world of flux, and if I stand still in those shallows for a minute, I am surrounded by the flitter and skitter of life. All kinds of resilient and defended creatures appear. Hermit crabs are suddenly busy on the seafloor in their winkles and whelks, like porters with trolleys at a station. Everywhere I look, they are about their business. Some of those shells are encrusted with patches of the limey, self-hardening seaweed, the pink coralline. One has a sprig of wrack growing from its shell, an eighth of an inch tall. They scurry across the seabed, hurrying between the crumble, crusty, frilly-topped tubes of the sand masons. There is a small greenish fish tooling around my feet, a common goby, less than half an inch long, its boxy body sprinkled with red spots, but with a bright green nose. I bring my hand down into the water beside and underneath it, a Gulliver presence in its Lilliputian world, and unlike any other fish I have ever known, it does not react, but continues poking and looking, dark and bubble-eyed, investigative at this intrusion, but not alarmed at the idea of an intrusion itself. A flicker-spotted fish glides past, sweeping its fins back and forth as it goes, spreading them in half-made embryonic fan wings, and then landing in the mud at my feet, the fish itself slowly reappearing from the dispersing cloud and puff of sand its arrival cast up. I photograph it, half in the shadow of my phone, half in light. A little juvenile dab, 3 inches from nose to tail, slides along the seafloor beside me, a ripple in every pore, moulding its body to the contours of the sand as if wedded to them, as close as possible to that miniature landscape, a creature as liquid as the sea itself, a film of life, but which, as it pauses, turns invisible, mottled like its surroundings, its greyness speckled with white, banking on a principle opposite to the hermit crab beside it, one almost stupidly visible, but dressed in borrowed armour, the other soft, subtle and discreet, the diplomat of this half-world, unseen to the heron that stands now 100 yards away from me, waiting intently and anxiously, ever ready to bid. In the ebbing tide, little fleets of grey, white and black shrimps suddenly appear. They are krangen-krangen, called brown shrimps, but they are far from brown. Hundreds of them making their steady, soldierly progress over the seafloor, spotted and marbled with the same mixture of white and brown dots as the sand, following the water as it goes, bounce swimming, antennae alert, settling for a moment on their toe-tips beside me, tails spread behind them in painted fans, all of them heading out to sea, away from the warming shallows. Nothing is coming the other way. Only with the next tide will the inhabitants of the beach return. I push a little further out towards the headland on the edge of the bay. The kelp fronds here come up above the water as if they were the fins of dead fish. The outer tips are broken and beaten by storms. Beneath their dark canopy is a graveyard of ex-lives, of smashed and abandoned shells, a recycling centre for the whole intertidal. Primitive colonies of tiny animals, sea mats, make hieroglyphs and diagrams in lobed and scratched patterns on the sheeny leather of the fronds. In the air, the sea mats are glamorous, but inert. Push them underwater, and within a moment they flicker into magical, frondy animal life. In the shade of these weeds, the most unlikely drawing-room colours erupt on a damp Scottish coastline. The coralline makes a vermilion mat where the limpets dig their nests. Venetian-striped top shells crawl between the dried blood-red of the beadlet anemones. Bright yellow and green sponges line the polychrome pools. All this aquarium life becomes visible if you pull the overhanging weeds away, but put your head in under the enormous, jungly, slimed canopy of the kelp, and you find yourself in a different country, threatening, shadowed, dark, and even haunted, where pink, fleshy starfish wear ghost-blue lines down each of their arms, where the purple-black dahlia heads of their tentacled mouths are all that can be seen of giant anemones half buried in the bowls of sand, and where, in these shadows, the king and dominator of this world, the green crab, blotched and mottled, with a whole night sky of spots and patches on his carapace, emerges as the terror giant of a miniature barnacled world. There is a line from a Gaelic love song, written in Mull, just across the water. Chatanich trai gan mulan nati. A low tide never came that wasn't followed by a high tide. Every ebb implies a flood, in a language where the word for ebb, trai, is the same as the word for beach. You will not find a beach without the promise of a rising tide. You may not love me now, but love will come one day. An ebb tide is only a full tide in waiting. Trust your life to the turnings of the sea. There is another side to it, the coming and going of the waters, their impermanence and unreliability, the sense in which the tide is a twice-daily catastrophe, has also played its part. In Applecross, on the west coast of the mainland of Scotland opposite Raasay, there is a bay called Obvadi Rue, the Bay of the Red Fox, from the story of a vixen that had been hunting on the shore who got her tongue deep into a large mussel which closed on it and held it while the tide rose and drowned her. Alexander Forbes, the early ethnographer who collected that story, also claimed that he found a rat drowned with its paw under a large limpet and its body twisted up in a crevice whence it had been unable to free itself. While Alexander Stewart, Victorian columnist in the Inverness Courier, found a dead kittiwake, but perfectly plump and fresh, lying on the top of a mass of drift tangle. One of its feet was firmly held in the vice-like grasp of a large mussel, the mussel, in its turn, being anchored by its byssus to a tangle root, Laminaria digitata, of immense size. The rising tide is unforgiving. This fluxing and flexing is a landscape, a halfscape, that reverberates with the mutability of things. It plays in our shared memory, part of the challenge the ocean always poses, as the American cultural critic Steve Mentz has said, to know an ungraspable thing. Some of the most famous lines ever written, Ariel's song near the beginning of The Tempest, embrace that shoreline ambiguity of perfection and destruction, the beautiful and the strange, the menace and caress of the sea. These early moments in the play are themselves full of uncertainty. Ferdinand, the young prince of Naples, thinks his father, the king, is drowned, but we know he is not. These kings and princes are now homeless vagabonds on a storm-blasted shore. Ariel himself, the soul of poetry, is disguised not as a creature of the wind, but as a little sea god, and as that watery spirit sings the most untruthful and enigmatic of songs. Full fathom five thy father lies. Of his bones are coral made. Those are pearls that were his eyes. Nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Sea nymphs hourly ring his knell, burthen, ding-dong. Hark now, I hear them, ding-dong bell. It is a hymn to the shore, afloat on sea sorrow. The king's body has become something like the floor of the sea. The colours of the shallow deep waft over him. He is faded rich. encrusting jewels enshrine his head, and his limbs transmute into submarine treasure. Everything that seems like threat and disaster is conjured here into a mask-like glimmer. His corpse is a wonder of the wavering seas, and yet this is a song of death, an obsequy in which the elegance enshrines fatal loss, a drowning, a breaking of human connections, where the body is subject to the violence of the waves, and where sea nymphs ring the funeral bell. It is a place both of salt death and of scarcely imagined perfection. What care these roarers for the name of king? The boatswain on their ship had cried, as the winds had shrieked about them, and now indeed the king has become treasure, lying 30 feet down. Sometimes, on a summer evening, when the tide is at full flood, and when, in the wonderful phrase Shakespeare used for this moment, it makes a still stand, the whole of the bay outside the house goes quiet. Across the mile between its arms, a calm extends from headland to headland, over what is, I reckon, about 300 acres of sea. If a fish moves anywhere in it, you can see that movement with your naked eye, the slightest stirring of its surface, a sleek molehill raised by the fish's tail and lit by the last of the sun. I have seen a sea trout on an evening like this, the best part of a mile away, reaching up out of the water and thrashing back down onto it in pure silence. Seconds later, the sound of its arc and fall came over towards me, and magically, once, a basking shark cruised to and fro across the bay, 20 minutes to the east, 20 minutes back, lazy and easy, leaving behind it, in that wide, still sheet of water, the triple wake made by nose, fin and tail, each dragging its own pink-lit pencil line across the calm. I realized soon enough that I loved that stillness, and that a rock pool would have it. I searched the bay but could not find one, only beaches and a wide rim of ragged stone in which there are no true hollows to hold the water. Then, I thought, perhaps I could create something like a stillness cupping pool, a parenthesis cut out of the world of flux, an extension in time of what in the open sea is only a moment of calm. A pool, or even two or three. To make them at the beginning quite naked, exactly as the words say, a rock pool, a dish of rock on the shoreline, as if it were part of the earth before life had come to clothe it, and then, slowly, to allow the sea to bring life to that dish, to make it a living thing. It would be gardening the sea, providing not flower beds, but life beds. The foreshore in this bay is presumed crown land. Long debate filled much of the 19th and 20th centuries over the ownership of that part of the land which is neither always wet nor always dry due to the ebb and flow of the incoming and outgoing tide. About half of the foreshore in Scotland was claimed by the neighbouring landowners, largely on the basis that their tenants, when gathering seaweed for fertiliser or to burn for its chemical residues, had paid the landowners rent for it. Scandalously, if rent was paid, ownership was implied. The relatively small amount of weed collected here meant that no rent was ever paid, and so this bay went unclaimed. As Crown property, it is now administered by the Crown Estate Commissioners for Scotland. Statutory public rights on the shore are thought to include, even if they are not yet enshrined in Scottish law, swimming, sunbathing, playing games, going for a walk, having picnics, lighting fires and cooking food, gathering shellfish, except mussels and oysters, to which the Crown retains the rights, fishing, except salmon, ditto, and shooting wildfowl, as long as they are over the foreshore when shot, embarking, disembarking, loading and unloading a boat, drying nets, gathering bait, and making sandcastles. I wasn't sure if my pools would come under the heading of making sandcastles, and so I applied to the Crown Estate Scotland for permission. They paused to think, but in the end, for a small fee, and with the agreement of Marine Scotland, the government sea agency, I was allowed to make some pools on the edge of the bay at the Rua an Tasunach. A little woundingly, when I eventually sent some photographs of the work I had done, Tony Bennett, the Crown Estate Marine Officer for Argyll, said, "I see no issue with them as they do not appear to be any different to anything built by local children during the holidays." All the same, the pools at Rua an Tasunach are now marked on the general asset map of the Crown Estate Scotland website with the CES reference number AR1-34-2. He was right, though. Making the pools, even if they each took days of work, was partly a way of playing with nature, partly to make good a lack, to create a still stand of my own, a small piece of a sea world by which I and Sarah and the children could wait and watch, and partly so that I could learn what this nature was. The pools would be discreet. I would be careful to keep them almost hidden, or at least scarcely noticeable. By definition, they would be invisible under the sea for much of the time. They would be an invitation to life, an act, as I learned to call it, of bioreceptivity, even bioreciprocity, an enrichment of the habitat, not a subtraction from it. The shore, as Seamus Heaney once wrote, is where things overflow the brim of the usual. And that brim is at the heart of this book. It is an old English word that has slowly migrated shorewards. Far back in its Germanic roots, the brim meant the turbulence of a breaking sea, a place where the world roars, and beyond that, in the sealess steppes of the Proto-Indo-Europeans in Central Asia, to brim was to hum like a bee, to make the noise of life. For the Anglo-Saxons, it became the surf at the sea margin. From there, it moved on again to be the lip or edge of anything, but one in which an overflow was always possible. A brim for us now is an edge at which the limit is gently but slowly reached, a place for the overtopping of a tide or flood, where, as Emily Dickinson once dreamed, our shoes would overflow with pearl. There is something about a pool which, not to make too gross a pun on it, encourages the reflective, leads the mind not merely to transcribe the experience of the actual, to give it a topography, but allows the questions of why it means what it does, what its reality consists of, to what extent everything that confronts you is more than the local. There are no boundaries here. The human, the planetary, and the animal all interact, and all of them are interleaved in the realities of the shore. None makes sense without the others. The billions of acres of galactic time and the varying gravitational fields through which this planet swings count for as much as the daily actions of people and all the behaviours of the creatures in the intertidal. These categories blur. Human life here, even human thought here, is identifiably animal. Animals develop social and cognitive systems, means of attack and defence, hierarchy and cooperation, propagation and survival, that look strikingly like the ways human beings organise their lives and societies. Clans of prawns live in the pools. Winkles can smell out their enemies. The pools are governed by the movement of the planets. Philosophical understandings can be applied to the ecology of invertebrates. The life of the crabs is attuned to the tides. This is not anthropomorphism, viewing the animal world according to terms more suitable to people, but its opposite, zoomorphism, recognizing the continuities between animal and human consciousness, the continuousness of the spectrum that runs from bacterium and virus to scientist and poet. all can exist only within the overarching embrace of the world as it is, each life driven by the need to be, each unaware of the significance of what it is that drives them. That unknowability is everywhere here and is part of what I mean to say. To know something, a person or an animal or a place, to become intimate with it, is not to know in any very conscious way, but to dissolve the boundaries. To be with anything, life must overflow its brim. We stand, then, on the shore, William Golding wrote in 1965, reviewing Gavin Maxwell's Ring of Bright Water. Not as our Victorian fathers stood, lassoing phenomena with Latin names, listing, docketing and systematizing, we pore instead over the natural language of nature, the limy worm casts in a shell, strange hieroglyphics that even in their simplest form may appear urgently significant, the symbols of some forgotten alphabet. We walk among the layers of disintegrating coral, along the straggling line of brown sea wrack, dizzy with jumping sandhoppers. We stand among the flotsam, the odd shoes and tins, hot water bottles and skulls of sheep or deer. We know nothing. We look daily at the mystery of plain stuff. We stand where any upright food gatherer has stood, on the edge of our own unconscious. The first Greek philosophers experienced the world as what they called physis, a term that is famously difficult to translate, but is somewhere close to the idea of growing. Nature, for them, was something in the act of becoming what Martin Heidegger, entranced by these early thinkers, called an upsurging presence, a process of arising, a self-blossoming emergence, a gift from nothing, the coming into being of being itself. That net of miraculous beginnings in all dimensions is what this book is about. Part 1. Animals. Chapter 1. Sandhopper. A bank of rolled and broken seaweed gathers at the head of the beach after storms, where it lies for weeks in long, dark bolsters. In the summer it can grow crusty on top, dried by sun and wind, with bits of driftwood and plastic caught in it, and the weed itself turning a mottled ochre, the colours of a fire that has burned down. But even then, when you lift away its upper layers, something else appears, the semi-liquid sludge of rubbish and rot, every surface slimed, not the bright, firm beauty of the sea itself, but a world thick with decay, the microbial tide surging through the tissues of the weed. Put your fingers in amongst its slipperiness, and you can feel the nutrients being released back into circulation, no longer shut into their organisms, but ready for another turn. It is the gift from the sea, delivered not by the beneficence of summer, but by winter storms that have torn the wrack from the seabed and brought it ashore. I begin now to poke into the mounds of weed. It is March, a cold, dampish day with spits of rain hanging in the wind. The air between here and Rua Untasunach has thickened into a mist. The waterfalls are running, but I cannot hear them for the gale. The grass is dead and brown, and there is scarcely a sign of spring. It is the end of winter, everything reduced and bitten down, shut like a filing cabinet drawer. The whole place feels bleached. The tides have been up over the grass, all kinds of things are mixed in with the wrack. Limpet shells, emptied of their inhabitants, upside down, cupping the rain. There is most of a tree in here, an ash, its bark chewed by the deer, whose teeth have scraped furrows into the wood beneath. A huge grey boy, torn away from a fish farm, is half buried in the wrack. The carapace of green shore crab has the double puncture of an otter's canines, crunched into the lid as if through a water biscuit. There is a hazelnut here, still whole, but when I bite into its shell, the taste is of salt and rot. The sea has got in, and the nut is pulp. The oyster catchers and sandpipers are spending their day picking through the weed like shoppers in a market, turning over the clothes for a bargain. There are opportunities to be had. Come closer, it is the governing instruction of life on the bay, and the rotting weed shows it is more full of life per square inch than anywhere on this late winter shore. Sink your hands into the slime and slither gloop of the disintegrating mass, and feel your way towards the creatures that make this place their home. There is a mass of them, millipedes and rack fleas, but what literally jumps out are the jumpers, the sandhoppers, the tiny crustaceans no bigger than the paring of a thumbnail that love the rotting weed. I have seen them 1,000 times before, and never considered their existence, never named them, never caught one, never looked at one, never thought what they might be beyond something like the energy of rot bursting up out of the sludge of disintegration. Now, though, the invitation takes me in. There are 2 kinds of sandhopper on Scottish beaches. One is pale brownish, called Talitrus saltator, the leaping knuckle jumper. Talus is Latin for a knuckle, talitrus for a finger flick, which spends the day buried in the sand and emerges at night to feed on patches of wrack. The other, with which I am more familiar, is pinkish and called Orchestia gamarellus, the little shrimp-like dancer, named after the troops in ancient Greece who performed on the dance floor, the orchestra, where the tragedies would also be played. Orchestia lives all the time in the wrack. Both Talitrus and Orchestia are amphipods. The name means that they have several different kinds of feet, and every time you open up their world in dissolution, they go through the same wonderful 3-part routine: leap, wriggle, play dead. Put the weed lid back on, lift it again, and they do it again. Leap, wriggle, play dead, finally curling up into self-protective balls in the shadows of the wrack. 18th-century naturalists had looked at them, often thinking they were a version of woodlice, but the first person to examine them carefully was one of the heroes of the shore, Colonel George Montagu, 1753-1815, scholar-soldier, veteran of the American War of Independence, founding fellow of the Linnaean Society, pioneering ornithologist, conchologist and mammologist before any of those terms had been invented. He ran off with a niece of Lord Bute when he was 20, but became bored by her grandeur, and after beginning as a pursuer of game, increasingly turned to the study of nature. In 1798, with his mistress, the Danish beauty Eliza Dorville, he abandoned his life and wife to set up with Eliza near Kingsbridge in Devon. Society was outraged. Montagu was disinherited by his family, court-martialed for creating a bad example, and so turned with exquisite patience and assiduity to the creatures of the natural world. It was a model for shore life. Ignore society, attend to this. Montagu spent his days poking about in the waters of Salcombe Harbour, naming species after species for the first time, including 100 new mollusks, acquiring a Montagu's blenny, Montagu's harrier, Montagu's ray, Montagu's sucker, a kind of fish, and Montagu's sea snail. Eliza provided him with a stream of children, the two never married, and made the calm and refined drawings that illustrate his books of birds and shells. Under these happy and free-thinking hands, the sandhopper entered the annals of science. Having watched the multitudes which are seen skipping about in all directions upon our sandy beaches in a summer evening, Montagu looked patiently and admiringly at the little creatures. He was one of the first British naturalists to examine both preserved specimens and the living animal, and to make regular use of a microscope. Through his eyepiece, Montague saw that the sandhopper was oblong, subcompressed, smooth, and extremely glossy. Its colour, when alive, corneous. When dried, it becomes paler, and by exposure to the sun, gains a tinge of pink, and the antennae partake of orange-yellow. It is frequently found on the seashores, bleached white. They lived in vast abundance, burrowing under the various rejectamenta of the sea, devouring both animal and vegetable matter with great avidity. If you can catch one of these mistresses of the rejectamenta and hold it by its legs, it does not, to be honest, look like an efficient design. A woodlouse and other isopods, which have, by contrast with the amphipods, only one kind of leg the length of their body, are compressed vertically so that their bodies are low, wide, and stable. These amphipods are compressed laterally, so they are tall for their width, with the same proportions as the trolleys that cabin crew push up and down the aisles of aeroplanes. You might think if you set an Orchestia on its feet, the high centre of gravity would mean it falls over. In fact, it doesn't, and stabilises itself by spreading its legs wide, like the legs of a camera tripod. Why the lateral compression? When either the Orchestia or the Thalitrus is disturbed, all the animals that have been exposed start to jump at random, scattering as chaotically as the bubbles above a newly poured glass of champagne. Prey animals of all kinds do this, zigzagging, spinning, looping, or bouncing away from the predator in what biologists have called protean flight, a storm of signals to confuse the killer, encouraging it to follow one, then another, and so allowing all the potential victims to escape. Mice, spiders, squid, fish, and broods of young songbirds often explode like this when an intruder threatens. If a single goal is sought, the offering of multiple options encourages indecision. Sandhoppers' genes have learned to overwhelm the processing capabilities of their predators. The Soviet marine scientist A.I. Bulyucheva very carefully watched an Orchestia hopping. She thought that it balances on a pair of legs in the middle of its body, draws its whole self tightly together so that its tail and enormously powerful back legs, they look under the microscope like the hams of a linebacker, are pressing into the sand, and then suddenly flexes its thorax so that it flings itself into the air, with no control over the direction it takes. The movement is astonishingly quick and effective. If you sit and watch them in flight, the impression is that each small animal is in one place at one moment, and another a second later, with no catchable transition between the two, animal quarks living in a strange quantum crustacean universe. Those back legs act as shock absorbers when it lands, or so Dr. Bulyucheva says, even though they seem usually to land on their sides to me. Meanwhile, Dr. G. Bracht from the University of Münster has filmed the whole performance at 1,000 frames a second and found that an Orchestia's escape jump lasts on average between a third and half a second, can cover a distance of 18 centimetres, and achieves an average acceleration on takeoff of 300 metres per second per second. Within that time frame, Orchestia usually makes between 4 and 6 somersaults. Be amazed! It is the fizz of life itself, the sand jumpers and weed dancers springing into spectacular rocket-fueled survival. As they jump, the huge supervising presence of the oyster catcher or sandpiper is confused. The final landing is a moment of vulnerability, when the predator can reorientate and find its prey. But the amphipod does not stand to be available once again to the hungry bird. It begins to wriggle on its side, like a rugby player caught in a tackle, all 9 pairs of legs hard at work, pushing the animals forwards and sideways, down in between the crevices of the rotting weed. No woodlouse or leg-based isopod could do such a thing, or at least so easily. The amphipod slithers toward safety, entirely capable on its side and with its relatively soft and shiny cuticle, far more pliable than the shells of the marine crustaceans, the shrimps and prawns, from which it is descended. The calcium carbonate that stiffens and hardens the shells of those sea creatures is not present in the exoskeleton of these weed dwellers. They choose escape over armour. A lighter shell makes them sprightlier for jumping and also makes them supple, so that they can slip and wriggle away into the protection of the gaps between the rotting weeds, hence the lateral compression. Once there, they fake death, curled up into a seed-like ball, whose sheer immobility is its camouflage. If you did not know they were there, you would not find them in the shadows and crevices of the weed, but poke about among these living dead, and they will, quite literally, spring to life again, running through the gamut of their evasions. Most of the nearly 10,000 amphipod species live in the sea, and these beach dwellers are the descendants of marine ancestors that have come to an enriched but more difficult world, one in which flux both provides the basis for life and is its enemy. Bundled-up wrack is delicious for them, but the temperature rises and sinks to greater extremes on land than in water, even inside the mounds of weed, and so desiccation, by definition impossible in water, becomes a constant threat. It is something life itself, the body itself, must defend against. That is one purpose of the semi-pliable, near-crunchy shell of these amphipods. If an orchestia loses more than 25% of its body water, it will die. They do their best to avoid such a fate. Orchestia has a system of pores in its protective shell. A layer of wax is secreted through them, waterproofing the shell, making it like the waxed cardboard in which the fruit and vegetables of organic box schemes are delivered. The wax will keep the orchestias damp inside. It has a melting point of about 37 degrees Celsius, which means the sandhoppers cannot go wandering about with any safety in full summer sunshine. If they did, their protective coat would melt and they would die of dehydration. Large-scale catastrophe can strike. One very warm May, when sunshine hung over the West Highlands of Scotland for 2 full weeks, the weed on the beach dried to the consistency of dark, wrinkled, uncooked pasta, not only in the upper layers, but deep down into the bulk of it. I went looking for the orchestias and, lifting the weed away in stiff plaques, found crowds and crowds of them lying there on the gravelly sand, dead and pink as if they were a plateful of cooked shrimps, the victims of drought and unseasonable early summer warmth. Normally, though, the wet weed is both hiding place and restaurant. If you remove the top layer of weed, but shade the orchestias as deeply as you can, they feel they might still be in something like the dark, and they begin again to lead the normal hidden life of the cryptozoic. They feed, nibbling on the weeds, and from time to time they also start to look after themselves, their little hands and feet feeling over the surface of their own shell coat for any grains or fragments that might be abrading it, breaking the glossy seal that Colonel Montague noticed, and so putting them in danger of drying out. Orchestia must groom to stay alive, in particular picking anything out of the joints in their legs, where a speck of dust or sand could damage the connecting membranes and allow the precious wetness of what biologists call the internal milieu to escape. To sit and watch them about their business, their multiple limbs flickering and pausing over their own bodies, keeping house, keeping themselves proper, ensuring their own continuity, is a challenge to any pre-existing idea of animal consciousness. They must know and feel where there is a speck of grit to be removed. They must know how to use the multiple tools of their various limbs in a way as effective and as complex as a multi-bladed penknife. They must be making decisions. They must have minds at work. Most of this was known in the 19th century, But from the early 1950s onwards, some astonishing discoveries started to be made about these tiny crustaceans. Largely in the hands of the Tuscan zoologist Leo Pardi. He was born in 1915 in a small town near Pisa, and in 1937 graduated from the university there. From the start, Pardi emerged as the most acute observer of movements and expressions, both in animals and men. With unforced lucidity, and soon becoming a brilliant teacher and talker, Pardi transformed the study of animal intelligence. All through the war, and up until 1953, at the Zoological Institute of Pisa University, he examined the habits of the paper wasps, in particular the ferocious struggles between a new colony's would-be queens, who bit and clasped and clashed their antennae until one emerged triumphant, called marvellously the Nestmutter, the Nest Mother, by Karl von Frisch, the great Austrian biologist and bee expert who had guided Pardi towards this study, while the others either left or retreated into a subsidiary status, called by Frisch the Hilfsweibchen, the little help wenches, which were organised in ranks below the Nestmutter. Wasps, it seemed, had as much of a status hierarchy in their colony as hens or wolves. What Leo Pardi discovered, through hundreds of dissections, was an extraordinary interaction of that social status with the body form of the wasps. Somehow, the alpha wasp, perhaps by some kind of hormonal signal, was able to inhibit the development of ovaries in her rivals. She became fertile, and her hormonal winds blowing over the colony ensured that her rivals remained barren. Pardi found that if a beta wasp was removed from the presence of the Nestmutter, the beta's ovaries were able to develop quite normally, and she could think of becoming a Nestmutter herself, hormonally depriving, in her turn, the gamma, delta and epsilon wasps of their chance to procreate, at least until they too were removed to their own colonies. A mental and social life, usually associated only with hens, wolves and people, had been found in the insects. Pardi published his discoveries in several international journals, encouraged by the great Dutch animal ethologist Nico Tinbergen and others, but in March 1950, his ideas were brutally attacked at a seminar in Paris by a French entomologist, and Pardi, hurt and exhausted, withdrew from wasps to something he could make his own, intertidal creatures, in particular the sandhoppers, which he found on the beaches of the Tyrrhenian Sea to the west of Pisa. In a pattern that repeats again and again in these stories, the edge of the sea was playing its part as a psychic refuge. Both Orchestia and Talitrus saltator usually live above the high tide mark, hidden either in the sand or in patches of wrack, which is damp and where predatory birds have trouble finding them. At night, they leave their hiding places. Orchestia tends to stay up at the top of the beach, but Talitrus goes on major expeditions, coming down towards the strand line and browsing there on whatever they can get in the rotting weed. As the tide floods again, they make their way back up the beach to safety. How do they do this? It is the question any of us might ask, but Pardi's asking it began a slow unravelling of the extraordinary capacities of these creatures. He and his co-workers found, first, that Talitrus responded to damp. If they were wetted with seawater, they would head inland. If they were threatened with hydration and were hot and thirsty, they headed for the sea. The direction of travel was reliably at or near 90 degrees to the axis of the beach, as nearly as possible either towards or away from the water. How did they know to go in those directions? Pardi's first discovery was that the sandhoppers on the Tuscan beaches had an internal sun compass by which they could work out where to go. The compass was combined with a clock, so that at any time of day, Talitrus could adjust its orientation and make either for the sea or the top of the beach. Pardi captured some of the sandhoppers from a west-facing beach, took them back to his lab in Pisa and put them in a small arena, 20 centimetres in radius, with pitfall traps all around the circumference. The floor of the arena was kept dry. Pardi allowed the sun to shine on it, and the sandhoppers still headed off westwards in the direction of what would have been the sea if they had been back in their Tyrrhenian home. If the apparent position of the sun was altered by using mirrors, the sandhoppers adjusted their escape paths to account for it. He then took some of them out to sea on a boat. They still headed west, or what they thought was seawards. Another group was carried over to the east coast of Italy on the Adriatic. Still, the sandhoppers in their enclosed arena headed west, in the direction of the sea they had known all their lives. What about at night, when most Thalitrus journeys were made? Astonishingly, it turned out that Thalitrus could use the moon for the same purposes, and that it had two clocks running independently of each other, one remaining aware of the timetable by which the sun came and went, the other the moon. If Thalitrus was kept in constant dark for many days, both clocks continued to run without interruption, and it would resume its sun and moon-guided walks as soon as allowed. As Pardi and his students continued to observe and experiment on Thalitrus, its celestial vision of sun and moon and the day and night attuned life rhythms became increasingly clear. Further experiments were made when sun or moon were hidden by clouds. Pardi found that even the Thalitrus could read the landscape and orientate itself accordingly, particularly if there were large buildings or cliffs above the beach to distinguish landward from seaward views. It could also tell the difference in colour between the long bluish wavelengths of light coming from out at sea and the redder and browner colours from the land. On top of that sensitivity, experiments revealed that they could read the difference between an upslope and a downslope. Thirsty sandhoppers tested in the dark would always head for the lower, i.e. seaward, end of a tilted box, at least when the sand beneath them was dry. If it was wet, they would head to the upper end. In 1962, Pardi moved to the University of Florence to become director of the Zoological Institute there. He and his co-workers collected sandhoppers from beaches on both the western Tyrrhenian coast and the Adriatic and bred from them in the Florence laboratory, keeping westerners and easterners quite separate. All four sets of Thalitrus, expert adults and inexperienced Florence-born offspring from both west and east, were set to work in the laboratory arenas, making sure each time they were in full sun. Not surprisingly, the adult sandhoppers from the Adriatic, placed on the dry bed of the arena sand, headed east, and those from the Tyrrhenian, west. Amazingly, though, their progeny, which had never experienced anything except life in the Florence laboratory, followed the same directions as their parents, if not quite with the same degree of accuracy. Pardi and his team had discovered that orientation in the Thalitrus was not something learned in life, but embedded in their genes, heritable from one generation to the next. At Porto Ercole, the summer resort for chic Roman families, two beaches reaching out to the peninsula of Monte Argentario face in nearly opposite directions, Gianella, just north of west, and Feniglia, just east of south. The Pardi team collected sandhoppers from both beaches and back in the Florence laboratory bred them together. If sea orientation, guided by the sun and moon compasses, was heritable, in which direction would the offspring of these contradictory impulses choose to go? The answer was clear, if extraordinary. Whether the mothers came from northwest-facing Gianella or southeast Feniglia, the result was the same. The progeny chose on average to go almost precisely southwest, within a few degrees of halfway between the two parental directions. Deep down at the genetic level, Thalitrus had inherited its compass, but the organism was no automaton. After a while on an east-facing beach, a Thalitrus with western-orientated genes can learn that it is not in its homeland and change its way of life. As the form of the beach shifts under tide, storm and wind, they can change their routes to and from the water. If they are kept in captivity for many weeks and then return to the beach they once knew, most of them have forgotten what it was like and make wrong or uninformed decisions about the direction they should take. And when exposed to the realities of a beach for a few days, they can begin to learn what it is like and make much better guided decisions about where to go when the tide is up or night has come or dawn is breaking and they need to return to the safety of their burrows in the sand. Pardi and his colleagues in Florence and Pisa change the way I see these hidden creatures. Each time I walk the beach and kick open, if only by chance, a pile of gathered wrack, I see them jumping at me as an example and epitome of everything this book is about, a fragmentary illumination of the layers of understanding, skill and volition in the most unconsidered corners of life. These half-soft, semi-elastic, glossy-shelled bodies shelter a decision-making, life-perpetuating, ingenious set of selves that has evolved over the eons. What reason may not go to school to the wisdom of bees, ants and spiders? Thomas Brown asked in Religio Medici. If he had been in Pardi's laboratory, he would surely have added Talitra saltator and Orchestia gamarellus. Ruder heads stand amazed at those prodigious pieces of nature, whales, elephants, dromedaries and camels. These, I confess, are the colossus and majestic pieces of her hand. But in these narrow engines there is more curious mathematics, and the civility of these little citizens more neatly set forth the wisdom of their maker. There is one further alarming aspect to their life. The sandhoppers' habit of chewing on what they find stranded on the beach means they are the great disassemblers of anything that is there, including human rubbish. Scientists at the University of Plymouth have found that if a normal plastic shopping bag is exposed to sandhopper shredding, it will be turned into about 1.75 million pieces of microplastic, the tiny toxic fragments that easily spread across the sea and which poison and pollute all forms of life from plankton to whales. That is one reason to pick up the mess. It is not beach, but sea cleaning.